Good morning and welcome to our meeting. It is 9:00 AM on June 4th, 2024, and time to convene a regular meeting of the Snohomish County PD Board of Commissioners. I'm Sid Logan, President of the Commission. To my right is Tony Olson, our Vice President. To my left, Rebecca Wolf, our Secretary. We have with us today John Parlow, our CEO, Colin Willenbrock, our General Counsel, Melissa Collins, our Commission and Executive Services Director, Allison Morrison, Clerk of the Board, Jenny Rich, Deputy Clerk of the Board, and Morgan Solson, Deputy Clerk of the Board. The written record will indicate others who are present. Please mute or turn off your cell phones or other electronic devices at this time. This session is for the Board and CEO to study and discuss issues among ourselves and with PUD staff. So our agenda item one is our CEO General Manager Briefing Study Session. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Commissioners. Just wanted to start the morning off to say Aaron Genesco just sent out an email, an update email on the storm activity, and they did call the storm at 7:00 AM this morning. Crews and all the support staff just did an amazing job over the past 36 hours I was monitoring from the other side of the country. But yeah, everybody did a fantastic job safely. All our customers restored. There's still some weather, as you probably noticed on your way in, so keeping some crews around to just manage those throughout the day. But another great Team PUD effort.
Seems like most of it's up north.
Commissioner, your microphone is off.
Actually, your district.
I was just looking at it. It looks like most of it's way up north. 3,000 is still up north.
Yeah, that's probably.
Near the Whatcom County line.
Yeah, I think that's one that came in this morning.
Yes.
And just kind of breakers tripping throughout the last day and a half or so. There was a lot of outages in the South County area. Some up the, we kind of shared the weather log across our territory, but yeah, great job.
But good job is, I'm not addicted to the outage, man, but I do watch it frequently. And what I would see, you know, I check back in every, and what I would see is areas got fixed within a very, very reasonable period of time. Unfortunately, then a few miles away, another area went out. But that was something I like to see, that what there was extended time periods where they were out.
Yeah, yeah, they had some quick restorations, and again, from a lot of the feeder outages where the bulk of the customers are experiencing the outage. And another huge kudos to the updates that the outage map team have done on the communication once we go into storm mode, how they're communicating. I noticed one of the features is in some of the comments regarding the storm activity, they're you know, describing where some of the crews are working and where they're focusing their efforts. And we've learned the more information we provide to our customers, the better. So we're killing it in that regard.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to hear after, you know, wrap up to see how many people are using those features.
Yeah.
And signing up to get text messages and stuff.
Yeah, yeah, well, and we will provide, I know the team will provide an update on that. So first up is our media update, and Aaron Sweeney. Good morning, Aaron.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Commissioners. Aaron Sweeney, Lead Communications Specialist. You stole my thunder, John. I was just going to talk a little bit about the broadcast tool that we use. That was really the first time we've been able to use that tool kind of in full force with a quick storm that we had a lot of outages and a really good chance to kind of get out there in front of our customers. We had three updates on the map throughout the day, kind of 6 hours apart. Worked with Aaron Genesco, Paul Kiss, Mark Fleury, all of them on getting those updates. And really we're trying to, you know, talk about where crews are at, the work that they're doing, and kind of give people an idea. So it just gives them a little more, you know, kind of information as they're, you know, going through the outages. And we're seeing less people go to social media to complain about a lot of them. So I think in that, that's anecdotal, but I think we are seeing a little bit of that success there.
Gives them more hope.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, just more information, right?
Yeah.
All right, media coverage. So a couple weeks ago, we had a nice story in the Everett Herald. They were actually doing a story on low Chinook numbers, but we were able to take a reporter and photographer out. They got to see the smolt trap, talk to Andrew and Kyle out there. Got a really nice story from our angle about just how much work the PUD is doing to care for fish out there and how much we're monitoring fish and all that. So it could have been one of those in-between stories, but Kelly did a good job of really getting out there and turning it into a positive story.
Yeah, it's a very good story.
We were also mentioned quite a bit in this, in the community transit electrified story. So they contacted us, just talking about, obviously, with CT going to electric fleets, that means a lot for us. And so we were able to talk about all the work that we're doing with them, both on grid expansion and kind of impacts to our power supply. So Garrison Marr helped out quite a bit with that. It turned out to be a nice story to just kind of shine a light on the collaboration that we're doing with community transit. Just a bunch of miscellaneous stuff in the news over the last month. We did the Everett Herald column on water conservation, all the talk about drought. We thought it was a good time for that. Also, Drinking Water Week is in May, so it felt like, you know, really an apt time to engage our water folks and shine a light on them. Paul Roberts wrote an op-ed on decarbonizing energy, obviously focused on us and the work that we're doing. And then a nice story, it was actually a press release. Hopefully you'll see more stories of this coming up, but this is we're one of only four utilities in the nation to develop some incentives with EPA's Energy Star Next Gen project. And this program is actually gonna be working with the residential building sector to kind of put this new technology into homes from the very start. So like I said, more to come on that, but they put a press release and kind of just kicking off that, that program. And then finally, group called the Municipal Research Services Center reached out to us, and we put them in touch with Don Presser. They wanted to do a story on our Woods Creek Sustainability Center and food forest, and just talking about urban agriculture, you know, talking about how, you know, we talk to the public about native plants and food production and all how it all kind of goes hand in hand. They did a nice blog on that and showcased us. Publications, The Wire in June is talking all about the big summer projects we've got going on. A ton from Marysville to Camino down south, just a lot of work. So we're just kind of shining a light on crews and what they're up to. And then also lots of other stuff in The Wire. I wanted to point out the 75th celebration. Ironically, we're talking about the inaugural day storm, but we're focusing on the 90s this month. And we have a nice feature on the website of Kathy Vaughn, Commissioner Vaughn. So she's our PUD pioneer for the month. So it turned out really nice. Also, I should mention, we have our 75th anniversary contest where we're doing drawings every month. We've had actually 15,000 entries over the first 5 months.
Wow.
And so we've done a really good job of promoting that, and our customers are really engaging
drawing?
With us in that.
Did you say drawing?
It's a prize drawing for a bill credit for $75.
Oh, wow.
It's nice. It's great.
And then finally, Kelly Stickney wrote a really great article in the NPPPA Bulletin. Focused on the Camino Island Transmission Project and all the innovative work that went into that and how much it really saved us money, kept that work in-house, and kind of just worked to work together as a, you know, crews and everybody to get that project done. So, great story. And I would also mention that John is the president of NWPPA, the board, and we are actually going to be featured on the directory. A picture, one of Krista's nice photos is going to be featured, so that'll be great.
Yeah.
All right, that's it for me.
I do have just an observation, and I think over the weekend I sent John a note on it. Big projects and getting out there and broadcasting it to the community. It started a year or so ago, but it's progressed to, I believe it's excellent. And because the customers can see what we're doing and why we're doing it. And you keep bombarding them with it, and it clearly is one of your strategic plans. And well done, keep it up.
Yeah, we know shining a light on that really shows customers all
Absolutely.
The work that we're doing. We know electrification's coming, so just get it. I'm actually meeting with a Herald reporter tomorrow at Jennings Park Sub to do another story on that, so just talking about all that work.
Yeah, the woodpecker story this morning.
Yeah, the wood. Yes, we put that in the press release and thought for sure somebody would reach out about it. So yeah, for sure. Anytime there's woodpeckers, now it's going to get lost.
Good animals.
Well, I thought you might pull up the one from our archives.
Oh yeah. Oh right. Yeah, for sure.
The woodpecker had gone here, and the pole was standing in about this much wood.
Yeah.
That actually.
That went viral.
Yeah.
This morning's story mentions that.
Oh,
yes,
it
was. Yeah.
It
was like a toothpick.
Yeah.
Is there something that we could put on the poles that doesn't cause any issues, like a painting or something that would scare the woodpecker?
I do believe on that project at Bunk Foss, they're replacing them with iron.
Well,
Well, so that'll probably.
The best help is yes.
Well, what if they say if you put owls on your roof, the ravens won't come by? Is that, did I make that? No.
Well, we have an avian protection program.
I put owls on the peak of my roof. Ravens just didn't pay attention.
I appreciated the coverage about the grant that we got to help open a new side channel on the Sultan.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know where I read that, but I did read it.
Yeah.
Maybe it was one of the linked stories relating to, like, it was Department of Ecology grant.
Oh, right, yes.
Half a million?
The press release, yeah.
It's quite wonderful.
Thank you, Aaron. Again, huge kudos to you and your team. You are just absolutely getting out of the park. All right, next up, our energy assistance update, Jeff Feinberg and Missy Wilch. Good morning, Jeff and Missy.
Good morning, commissioners. Good morning, everyone. We're excited to be here this morning. Jeff Feinberg, Senior Manager of Energy Services, and with me I have Missy Wilch, Program Manager in Energy Services as well. And we're going to be kind of tag-teaming this presentation this morning. And looking at the date on this, I was surprised that it's been since October of 2019 that we've talked only about our energy assistance program with you guys. And so one of the questions I'm going to have for you guys kind of as we complete our presentation this morning is, what is the right frequency of us bringing these updates to you? Because there's been a lot of work going on, and we're going to be talking a little bit about that and sharing the results of that. But I do think that every 5 years is probably not frequently enough to be telling our story, and especially with what we shared today of how frequently we're going to be making some updates and trying some new things. I think we're going to want to, you know, bring those fun results and those great stories back to you guys at a different cadence. So just have that in the back of your mind as we kind of move through this. And we're going to be presenting a lot. There's obviously the opportunity to interrupt us while we're doing that, or to have questions at the end of our time this morning as well. And so, just to kind of level set our expectations, there's no decision needed from you guys today. This is just an opportunity to kind of get you up to speed on really two big things. One is, we're going to talk a little bit about Clean Energy Transformation Act, and we just recently completed our second reporting cycle for the energy assistance portion of that law, and we kind of want to share those results and kind of what we've shared with the state. But then we also want to talk programmatically about what we've learned as we kind of assess our own program and our portfolio and how we're going to use data to continue to reformat how we do the work we do. And that'll be largely Missy sharing, and we want to be really clear here that when we share any of the results that we're sharing the results that are of a large team effort, right? We've got our CSRs that are the ones day-to-day implementing this discount program, that are working with our income qualified authorization partner in Snohomish County, that are working with our LIHEAP partners. So Missy and I are here representing the work of a lot of other people. We're just the ones that kind of talk about it kind of at the, I guess, the strategic vision level. And so that's kind of what we're sharing today. And so with that, let's just jump right in. So twofold, energy assistance reporting, we're gonna talk about that and then what we're gonna do next in the program. So number one, let's talk about the Clean Energy Transformation Act. You guys are aware that this really is ultimately a decarbonization law, right? It's about decarbonizing the fuel mix here in Washington State. It was signed into law back in 2019. However, one of the interesting things is this is the first time that now the state has mandated that utilities are to offer energy assistance in a formal way. Now, this wasn't news to us, and you guys will recall that we've had our rate discount since the early 80s. We've had Project Pride available for customers since not too far after that. And we've been a partner with Income Qualified Weatherization at Snohomish County for years and years and years. And so for us, the challenging piece or the nuance of this law as it relates to energy assistance wasn't really a challenge for us because we already had a pretty robust complement of programs. However, what the law did do for the first time for us is it asked us to first assess what is the overall need in our community of assistance and how are we charting progress as to whether or not our programs are effectively meeting those needs. And so now under this law, in addition to offering the assistance, we have to do assessments of the assistance that we offer, and we have to understand of customers that are defined as vulnerable and that have energy burden challenges, how are we doing at meeting their need? How are the investments that we're making in energy assistance reducing that burden over time? And even ask us to set targets. And basically, of that customer subset, how are we going to be able to reach 60% of that need by 2030? Or 90% of that need by 2045. And so we're just gonna share a little bit about what we've learned in our recent reporting cycle.
So I'm a little confused if you go back. I guess, first of all, I apologize because I felt ignorant about this part of CETA. This was part of CETA. So is the, we have to develop targets? We have to meet those targets, right?
That's the interesting thing with the way the law is written. It actually just talks about progress and understanding what the amount needed to meet those needs are.
Okay.
So it's almost in an exploratory way that utilities just need to A, offer assistance so that no customers are being left behind, and then to determine and understand, and if we were to meet all the need of customers that are overburdened,
right,
what would that cost us by these different intervals?
Okay.
However, and this is a little bit outside my area and more Kim's team in government affairs, we also know that kind of in parallel to the last reporting cycle, the legislature did say and commission a study about what a statewide energy assistance program might look like. And some of that was directly related to the reporting that came through the first cycle of energy assistance reporting from CETA. And please correct me if I'm wrong about it. So there's kind of this parallel piece, right? The law is basically asking us to offer programs and then assess their effectiveness, but there's not necessarily teeth as to whether or not we hit the 60s or the 90s, just to understand the funding needed.
Yeah. But I can imagine that also signals the interest in this, the state has in pursuing this further, and it makes sense. So.
Are they going to fund it?
Sorry?
State, if the state legislature passes something, are they going to fund it?
It's a great question.
I don't need an answer today. I'm just being smart.
What I will say,
that was one of my questions for today.
What I will say is we're very engaged in the workshops that the state are hosting as it relates to the energy assistance program, and we're offering comments and feedback both from a program staff standpoint and government affairs team standpoint as well.
Well, we might be threatened by the initiative that's going to be on the ballot that would take away a lot of the funding, since you mentioned it. That's in the back of my head now.
Yeah. Well, this conversation is a perfect segue to this next slide. So, let's talk a little bit more about what we've learned. And so I want to define these terms just in case we need the reminder. So when the law CETA is talking about energy burden is the amount of a household income that's spent on the energy bill. And under the law, what's determined as overburden is if any household is spending more than 6% of their annual household income on their energy bills, that burden, you know, studies have shown, is effectively where households have to start making decisions about, am I going to get pharmaceutical drugs, or am I going to pay my power bill? Am I going to get more food, or am I going to pay my power bill? So the law asks us to look at those customers. Now, what's interesting about energy burden, though, is it's not simply about socioeconomics. It's about socioeconomics, and it's about consumptive data in a household. So that's when we get to this other portion about vulnerable customers. And so the law asks us to look at either the greater of 80% of area median income or 200% of federal poverty level. And you guys may not be surprised to know that in Snohomish, King, and Pierce County, area median income is the more effective measure of where income's at in order to, you know, take care of your household needs. And so for us, when we're looking at the customers we need to serve under CETA and understand those progress goals towards, it's customers that are at or below 80% of area median income socioeconomically, and then their energy burden is above 6%. And so in our assessment, we found that that's roughly 22,000 of our households that fit that criteria of both income qualified below 80% and energy burden above 6%. And that's kind of a graph of our overall residential customer base. If you want to just see where everybody sits there, that breaking point is the 6% line. So you can kind of see the customers that are on one side of that and the customers that are on the other. And so whenever we're looking and assessing our program, these are the customers we're targeting and trying to figure out what would the right amount of funding and program work look like in order to bring these customers underneath the 6% burden. And we're not only concerned about them, but under the law, that's the main customers we're trying to focus in on.
So is the 6% burden all our energy consumption, natural gas, fuel oil, or is it just our energy?
That's a great question. So whenever we're looking at electric-only customers, we're using 6%, and that's what the state's asked us to do. When we're looking at our dual-fuel customers, we're kind of setting a proxy of 3% for electricity and 3% potentially for other fueling.
Okay.
And the external vendor that we used to help us do our assessment, because we kind of wanted a neutral assessment, not our own, he has used that proxy for a variety of utilities throughout the state and shown that it's a really effective way to kind of capture the dual-fuel customer.
And I'm sure I know the answer, but on the previous slide, 22,000 would sometimes we mix up customer and meter. These are citizens.
These are meters.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I should have defined it that way, right?
Yeah.
So, and so that's an important thing.
Yeah.
And we're gonna dig a little. I mean, I'm gonna share a little bit more about that. But yeah, we're talking about meters when we talk about 22,000. But it's a really important thing for us to think about. And really, one of the things we want to be offering here today, as we talk about how we think about this program work, is really thinking about energy burden reduction. Really does have to transition us to thinking, instead of billing assistance and helping people just pay the bill month to month, how do we actually give them energy assistance so that we can get not just necessarily the symptoms that are causing the challenges for them keeping the lights on, but how do we also thread that with some of our other goals so that it truly allows them to kind of be empowered, right, to take control of their consumptive situation in their home. And so we're thinking about that at a programmatic level, because that's ultimately actually to the good of the end use, but all ratepayers, right, to make sure that we're investing that appropriately. And so with that, here's the good news and the interesting news. The good news is, when we look at our funding assessments, in 2023, we were about $9.6 million, give or take, of the need. And we defined with those 22,000 households, the need to bring them all below 6%, based on our assessment, would have been an investment of $15.3 million. So the good news is, as we sit here at the conclusion of 2023 and then 2024, we are already beyond the 60% of the need that the law asks us to contemplate by 2030. We're roughly at 65%. But what that does is it makes us want to dig a little bit deeper into the numbers and say, well, what are we getting for what we're leveraging in these programs? And what we find when we look a little bit more into the details is that 10% of the highest use participants are actually using between 25 and 30% of that assistance funding. And then the 50% of the highest use participants utilize roughly 78% of that program budget. So if you think about that, I mean, what are some get, I don't want to put you guys on the spot, maybe, but I will. So what might we deduce when we can see that, right? That our highest users are over-leveraging the assistance funding. What that ultimately tells us is that billing assistance alone is not the only solution, right? That assistance isn't going to be the same, and the need is not the same for all the customers. Not all housing stocks the same, not all renter owner situations the same. And so we've got to have a unique way of thinking about designing programs to serve this overall need. And so to dig a little bit further in that, this slide illustrates this, and I probably should have put more talking points around this, but ultimately what we want to show on this slide is this. Sometimes there's this misnomer with income-qualified customers that because they're on the discount or because they receive other assistance, that maybe they use and consume a lot more electricity than other residential customers. And what we found in our assessment is that there's actually very little difference if we only look at economics alone between low-income customers and all other residential customers. However, when we bring in the energy burden piece and we look at the customers that are above that 6% amount, what we see is they're spending roughly $550 to $600 more a year on their energy bills.
So is this saying, Jeff, that we are, at this point, we're not really, we've signed up many customers in our low income program, but we've not, in generally, signed up a good proportion of the high burden? Is that what this is saying?
What I would say is it's saying we're doing a good job signing them up for that income qualified discount, and the income qualified discount alone for some of our customers is not actually going to help them reduce their energy burden effectively. And so what we're going to be talking a little bit more about here over the next few minutes is we're now at a place where, what I'll say, Missy's going to talk a lot about how she's refining that program to make it really easy for a lot of customers to come and join us with a discount, because truthfully, we don't know a customer's energy burden until we know their household income.
Right.
And a lot of times, the best way we can get their household income is once they enroll in a program and they offer to share that with us. So in a lot of ways, we're using our discount program as a real big front door to get everybody in that front door so we can start learning more about them and talking to them about other ways we might be able to serve them. And then the other piece that we'll talk about here in a minute is really threading our energy assistance programs with some of the other shared goals we have as a utility that all of our ratepayers care about, our energy efficiency goals and targets, our constrained circuits where we might be able to support other parts of the district by directing our conservation in a really specific way. And so we're gonna really get nerdy here towards the next few slides. But any questions before I move on?
On this slide, I do have a question. And that is, who are those in the non-low income category? How are they selected, and why are non-low income
customers being given assistance. I don't understand the meaning of non-low.
Yeah, and so in this instance, we are not offering assistance to non-low income. What we did is we did a sample set of customers, and we said, of those already any of our qualifying programs, here's a snapshot of their annual consumption, and then of other Schedule 7 residential customers that are not involved in income qualified programs, here's a group of them, and here's a snapshot of their consumption. Yeah, and we really wanted to do that because, again, I think oftentimes we think, oh, maybe the usage is really, really different. But really what we find here is energy burden really is kind of that critical link to understanding. It's not just necessarily the socioeconomics of a customer that are showing why they're struggling, but it actually has a lot to do with both housing stock and some of those other opportunities and socioeconomics.
If you touch on this later in the presentation, I don't need an answer now, but am I making an incorrect assumption that the low income is more transient in terms of, it's the meter, I guess, but that meter then is identified in a certain way as customers move, does that stay with the individual?
It's a little bit of both. When they qualify for one of our programs, it is 100% the household that qualifies, and it's not necessarily the meter.
Okay.
And I would say, in looking at the demographics of our customers that are currently in programs, it's all over the board. We have several that move frequently and throughout multifamily units. We have plenty that are single household homeowners that are also on our programs and stay on our programs year over year. But program participation has everything to do with the household specific income data.
All right, thank you.
Yeah.
One more question for you, leave the slide. So the 9.6 million, is that all money that we budget, or is some of that LIHEAP or other programs that we're helping administer?
Yeah, great question. So this particular 9.6 is looking at three different programs. One is our Project Pride program, which is customer donations, and we just simply pay the administration fee to St. Vincent de Paul to implement for us. The other is income qualified weatherization, which we find out of our energy services budget, and we co-find dollar for dollar with Snohomish County and their weatherization program. And then the last one is our income qualified rate discount, which technically isn't budgeted in the traditional sense. It's a reduction of retail revenue. But we do give those estimates every year to the budget office of what we expect that number to be as they build their forecast.
Right.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. All right. So I'm about to turn this over to Missy to share a lot more about her great work. But what we want to do is kind of talk about, so those are kind of the results. And again, those are good results. I'm going to be really interested whenever kind of the state aggregates everyone's results of this reporting cycle. I'll be really interested to see where our current funding levels are at by percentage versus everyone else, because I think we're doing a good job in that way. Again, our challenge right now, though, is how do we get a little bit deeper into making sure that those investments are the best investments possible for all of our ratepayers, both for the vulnerable customer and for everyone. And so what we're doing is kind of have a phased approach of how we're looking at expanding this program and getting even more detailed about our work. And so Missy's going to share a lot about phase one, because that's what she's been deeply invested in over the last 6 months, and really building on some of the work of our previous program manager, Jennifer Keene, as well. We'd be remiss if we didn't talk about her and some of the work she did to set Missy up for this. But Missy's done incredible things. What we're really trying to do in phase one is refine our current programs and approaches, right? Where we said before, we need a toolbox, and we know that what we've got is not a one-size-fits-all. What we do know is our big one-size-fits-all, the discount, is a great front door. And so how do we make it an easy front door, and how do we get a lot of people in it? And so Missy's going to talk about that. Then second, I'm going to get really geeky and share a lot of fun things we're doing with data now that we have at our fingertips to really evolve the way we do our programming and to build things specifically for customers and the acute needs that customers have. And then third, we're going to talk about kind of a philosophical transition in how we're marketing and outreaching our program as well. And so with that, I'm going to pass it over to Missy. And I didn't introduce Missy very well. She's a ringer, and we're so lucky to have her. So Missy's been with the district for 10 years. She's only been in energy services for the last 6 months, but prior to that, she was a customer service representative, and then for several years, she was a customer service lead. And the group that she led as the lead on customer service was a lot of our back office account control desk. And so for someone who has a perspective on both the frontline customer experience, troubleshooting really unique customer situations, dealing with things like BPP desk, dealing with agency desk, discount, the LIHEAP program, things like that. Missy has a deep invested knowledge, both as a CSR, but also a community member. And so it was real easy and a great get for us whenever she was interested in the position, and she was able to move over and take on this work for us in December. And so with that, I'll let her share about what she's been up to.
Nice to meet you folks.
Welcome.
Okay, so I'm going to just talk a little bit about, like, when I started, where Jeff sort of, he gave me a path that he wanted me to go down. And currently, let me just do a quick recap of where we're at on our current discount program. So we have a tiered discount program. It's a 50% discount for anybody that falls in the 0 to 100% poverty level. 101 to 200, they get a 25% discount. Just a little side note, we've estimated there's about 30,000 plus households that are under that 200% poverty level. I'm sure you guys are well aware of how inflation has affected people. We currently have 13,000 enrolled in our income qualified discount program. So we have some work to do, right, to get to that 30,000 number. So when he asked me to sort of look at this, the one thing that has been very apparent is we do a lot of paperwork. We still do paper, like a lot of paper. We had no online application. We didn't have a means that was easily accessible for our customers to get us the information that they needed. There's a lot of paperwork. That also means there's a lot of paperwork for us to manage once the customer submits it. So we were evaluating every single income application that came in with the associated paperwork. It's very time consuming, just so we're aware. With that, there's a lot of information that's lost in that paperwork, such as a fancy little box that shows up with the customer's signature that says that they are interested in future energy assistance programs. That is a big deal. That is how we get people on our radar. Well, if we're processing paperwork, it's too hard to get to everybody to get to that 30,000 number, right? The other thing that gets lost in the paperwork, and I'd be kind of remiss if I didn't talk about this, is, you know, I found myself in a position pre-PUD where I had to be one of the people that navigated through this paperwork. It is daunting. It is overwhelming. It's not fun. And a majority of the people that find themselves in that situation likely are going to give up and not fill out the paperwork at all. Right? So we need to figure out ways to make it easier and more accessible for people. Oh, I use the clicker, right?
Well, Missy, technology is also a challenge for a lot of people. So if you keep going.
Yes, I will get to that because this is part of what we're looking at. We have a lot of seniors.
Yeah.
A lot of people that really do struggle with the technology aspect of it. So how do we meet them where
they have the technology?
Yeah. Which is part of the challenges. So, you know, we do have, as part of this refining process, you know, in knowing what I know coming from the customer service side of things, we discussed what needed to happen. So I decided to sort of strip back the discount program as we had it. We keep, I think, adding on and changing, and our systems change and the world change, but we didn't really change what we were doing with the application. So something had to change with it, right? Because everything around it has changed. So we identified some challenges. The first challenge, which there's a huge focus on the PII information everywhere right now, right? Well, in order for us to like solve that challenge, we got sharing agreements in place with some of our community partners. We have a secured SharePoint with a couple of our community partners, which is encrypted, and we get okay to discuss from the customers to make sure it's okay for us to share information on their behalf. In addition to that, the other challenge that we identified is there's a difference in the way that other people, our community partners that we want to partner with, do their work, right? They use different terminology. They have different methods in which the way that they communicate with their customers. We had to determine what we could control in our doors, in our building, right? With the information that's being provided to the customer. So I had to go learn like different technology. One of the biggest ones was the school lunch program, and I'll get to that in a second. They have a whole different set of forms and whole new list of acronyms, which,
yay,
more acronyms.
And different laws, too.
I had to build a whole new spreadsheet of acronyms, and I didn't think that was even possible, but it is, it is. You can always have more sheets for acronyms. Third challenge is customer feeling empowered and valued equally. Again, I go back to people want to know that they're working with a safe place. So one of the that they're safe and that they're okay to come and ask for help when it's time for them to do that. So the solution to that is open and consistent messaging between our community partners that we partner with and our customers. The communication, we kept it, trying to keep it simple and intuitive to meet them where they are, not keep it overly complicated. And Jeff will point this out later on in the presentation, but QR code for accessibility, it's a thing. It's a new thing. It's a great new thing. This is a district promoted priority, and I think letting our customers know that we have this as a priority is actually very key for them knowing that this is a safe place. So part of the refining process, we're leveraging our agency partners to sort of reduce some of the redundant verification processes that they have to go through to get help. They have to go to LIHEAP and provide all of their income documentation. They have to go to DSHS and provide all their documentation. They have to go all these places and provide all their documentation. Well, we want to work a little bit smarter, not harder. We want to utilize some of the good work that some of our community partners are doing. So Project Pride is a perfect example. Customer goes into Project Pride. Project Pride verifies their income. They send over a pledge to us. You know what? We have the ability to take that information that they've already verified and get them on our discount. The work has already been done. So we're just putting auto enrollment processes in place to make sure that it's streamed forward and we're covering all of our auditing basics, right?
So can we do that automatically without the customer being involved?
Yeah, we do that. We started it, in February, I think, with Project Pride. They basically send over, they have signed their, it's okay to discuss information when they do the application with Project Pride. So now what happens is when Project Pride sends us their check, they send a spreadsheet along with it that gives us all the income household information for us to be able to implement and put in the discount. It's seamless. We do the same thing that actually stemmed from LIHEAP. We've been doing that for LIHEAP since 2013, I think. Yeah, since right around 2013. And it's progressed. It's gotten better and better and better. So it's just like automatic with them now. DSHS, we went through an extensive interview process in order to get access to their benefit verification system, which is not easy to get. To Jeff for that, because he's the one that sat through all those interviews to get that access. But now what a customer can do is just provide us their social security number or their DSHS verification, like an ID. We can go on and verify that they have active benefits with DSHS and go ahead and get them on the discount. National School Lunch Program, this launched last August, but we did some revamping in between January and February because, again, remember when I said schools and everybody, well, you would think all the schools use the same forms. They do not. All schools are different. They all have different terminology, so it took a hot minute for me to figure out what in the heck all of them were talking about, right? So we got that all in line. We figured out the requirements, and now if a customer is qualified for free or reduced lunch, they can send us a copy of their lunch letter and we will get them on our discount program. So we're utilizing that as well.
So does it work the other way? If we have a customer, I guess we don't know if they have students, so they can't.
Right, we can't share with them. Plus there's sharing agreements, and this is where the state of Washington is very strict when it comes to PII. So the sharing agreements we can receive, but like we have a very strong relationship with the LIHEAP office. And I keep asking, is there a way for us to provide our customers over to you to just get them the LIHEAP help? And they can't do it. It just doesn't work that way. I would love for it to be that way. That's on my wish list if you want to go ahead and figure out a way to make that happen.
I'll keep working on it. One more question. So in DSHS, your second bullet says limited access but enough to meet our needs. Mm-hmm. So did we challenge what our needs are? Right? I mean, because our needs also make barriers for people. So did we, when you went through this process, did we challenge what we truly need, like to pass auditor?
I'm gonna get to that.
Okay.
Because I had to look at what DSHS was willing to grant us and what we really needed from the customers. That's part of this whole stripping back of what we've piled on top of our application over years, which is kind of a mix-mash of stuff. Tribal TANF, this is basically the same as regular DSHS TANF, but we get an Excel spreadsheet directly from the tribes in an encrypted shared you know, document, and we're able to just, every month, they send us a list. And so like this month, we got 7 people that had moved in onto tribal land that received tribal TANF that we were able to put on the discount. Yeah.
Okay. So again, we can do that without even contacting the customer. We can just look up their address and figure out their meter and well, that's what it
is. Directly in regards to the relationship that we have with the community partners that are willing to do the sharing agreements with us and go through some of the things to get us the information we need. Yeah. It's a partnership.
You mentioned not informing the customer. I'm a customer.
Oh, the customers get
all of a sudden I get a bill.
Yeah.
That, so aren't they made aware before they get that bill so they understand why it's?
I will rephrase. They get a letter saying that they're approved for a discount. They do get a letter that states that. And like LIHEAP, I think when they go into LIHEAP, LIHEAP will give them a little bit of notice saying, you know, you'll likely be put on the discount.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Is it true that members who live on the reservation, like the Tulalips, don't have individual mailing addresses in some cases?
I'm not aware of that, potentially.
I learned that because of the inability to have individuals registered to vote.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be related to their addresses. So I don't know.
They give us mailing addresses. The tribal TANF though, our partner that we work with there, she advises them that they'll be put on the discount. And she's really even good enough if for some reason a customer doesn't see or doesn't understand their bill, she'll reach out directly and say, okay, this customer's not understanding. And so I'll get a hold of the people down in the customer service department to communicate and make sure that the customer understands. So after stripping back the existing application, we launched a refined application, and we have finally launched an online application. So a customer can go on and not print out a form and handwrite in all the stuff. They can actually do this online. We launched this online application on the 1st of May. Since the launch, at the time that we did this presentation, there was 327 apps processed in addition to paper alone. That is huge. It's 188 increase in that period. Just so you know the dates, it was 5/1 of 24 to 5/25 of 24 was from last year to this year, 188% increase. So that is good news.
When I got to this slide, I would imagine that there are a lot of seniors on the program, and perhaps folks, because they can't afford a laptop, iPad, or whatever, is there another way to get to them? We're showing this, but you could be missing.
They can do it from their phones too, just so you know. But we do have the ability. One of the things that I talked with Jeff about upon coming back from a sabbatical was getting iPads for people like on the front line, because our CSRs can actually help the customers now fill out these applications, which is a huge deal. Huge deal. We also have a program with our field representatives where, you know, our field folks, if there is somebody who is maybe tied to their home, they can't leave for some reason, we do have a field rep that can go out and assist them. Yeah. So there are opportunities. Seniors are where we're coming for next. So hold that thought, because I'm going to touch on that in a minute.
So is this in the My Snowbud app, or is this a separate?
It's, you can link to it if you go to My Snowbud from the bill assistance.
Okay.
Yep, you click, and the paper form is, because some people still like their paper. We're not gonna tell people that they have to do the online app, but it, there's a link that you click on right there. The other cool part about that is there's a language translation, so customer has the ability to change their browser, where right now, paper forms, we only have it in Ukrainian, Spanish, Russian, and English, right? And it's painstaking to get those, you know, like that. But with the online application, they change their browser over, they fill it out so it could show up in Russian, but when it translates, it sends to us in English. We get it. It's kind of seamless.
We offer our, you said there's only a few
languages? For the paper applications that we offer.
South America and...
like other languages?
Other than, I just heard very few, and I didn't understand.
Yeah, so...
why there wouldn't be many more offered.
Yeah, because it's hard for us to get the actual paper translated for the people that are filling it out to understand.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so those people that speak a language other than the four that we have to offer, they have to go get translation services to have somebody help them fill out that paper. That's another reason why this online app is really kind of a game changer.
Yeah. Another barrier removed.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. That's exactly what we're trying to do, is get rid of those barriers.
So with that bottom bullet, isn't saying that CSRs can complete it for the customer. I guess if they're in person, they can.
They can, well, CSRs can complete a majority of the application over the phone as they're talking to them. So thank you for mentioning that. I was gonna touch on that and I might be a little nervous, so I might have spaced it. I personally feel like this is gonna change the way that CSRs interact with customers and I think it's gonna help reduce some of the handle times. Some of the biggest barriers were when CSRs are trying to help customers and they can't because the customer's sitting with a paper application. With this online application, what can happen is the CSRs can fill out to the point of where the customer has to sign and acknowledge. They can hit the save button, send a link to the customer gets on, maybe uploads their one document that they have to and hit submit and they're done. The other thing you gotta think about too is, like, remember I was talking about the school lunch letter. Some picture a mom standing in the lunch office and she just gets her lunch letter, right? Her, you know, free or reduced lunch letter. She can get right online, and I've gone to the schools and they have the QR code that links directly to the application sitting in the lunch office. So mom scans it with her phone, takes a picture of her lunch letter, submits it, and she's done.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty darn cool.
That's fantastic, but again, I don't know what portion of population in this segment are not very literate in, well, they can't afford, well, I guess they can afford a phone, but
right.
But they struggle.
Which is why we're trying to focus
beyond the basics.
Why we're trying to focus really highly on the auto enrollment, because a lot of the people, one of our community partners, you know, the feedback that she gave me in regards to our application, our current paper application is pretty daunting. It's overwhelming just to look at. It's, everything is squeezed in on a front and back page. It's overwhelming, especially when you've got a lot going on. So we purposely tried to structure the online application to be very easy to navigate, very straightforward and not overwhelming. And we tried to structure it in a way to where if you qualify for one of the auto enrollment programs, those pop up first, so you don't even got to go down the verification of income path and send us, you know, 3 months of your documents, which we also reduced down to 1 month because every one of our community partners only asked for 1 month of income verification. We were requiring 3. That's pretty difficult for somebody who gets paid weekly,
mm-hmm.
You know, send in however many pay stubs for, you know, 3 months worth of, that's a lot. That's a lot to ask of our customers. So those are the types of things, those little things that we actually ask the questions. Do we really need all this documentation? Do we really need all this? And how can we streamline it? With that, I think I'm gonna let Jeff get nerdy.
Just wanna acknowledge that we're well over the amount of time that we asked for. So.
Well, that's due to our.
That's our, that's on us.
Well, no, this is great, and we're very happy to do this. I'm just also apologizing to Allison and others when we said 20 to 25 minutes. So what I also wanted to share here too that isn't on this slide that Missy spoke to a little bit is we're really close with three of our largest income qualified housing providers. We're really close to also having auto enrolled relationships with them. And then, you know, we joked about it, but the truth is we're coming for the seniors next. And we don't know all the different sort of senior service organizations that we're hoping to partner with, but that's really our strategic focus. So if you think about it, we've tried to think about, you know, what are some of the standard assistance channels, right? And so we started with kind of food and made food a really big focus for us, food and that kind of acute income qualified assistance. And then we wanted to move on to housing. And then we're thinking about, you know, demographics as it relates to seniors and then sort of, you know, language of origin and that sort of thing and people doing work in that way. And so that's kind of how we're expanding the reach of some of these auto-enrolled relationships. The housing providers are close, but I mean, this is something that I'll say, this is challenging, right? Because every time we onboard one of these new relationships, we then get to work with Colin's team. Jeff Kallstrom was really helpful with us. In the past, we've got Paul McMurray now. So we have to work with our own legal folks at looking at data sharing agreements and boilerplate language as to who can share what and how. We've got to work with our dig office, and then we've got to work with that organization's legal team and their dig office about how we're going to share our mutual customers' information. So each one of these relationships is sort of a net new relationship where we're kind of building on what we've learned, but also figuring out what they need in order to make this work. So I just want to share that because Missy didn't allude to that, but there's like a lot of time of like calling and waiting, a lot of time of sending and reviewing, and a lot of time of just kind of nursing these relationships to get us to the point where the end-use customer can see the impact of it. And so it's just pretty cool. And she's been incredible at the job. So where are we going next? And this is going to be really cool. I can't wait to show you guys. Okay, so this slide, phase two, data-informed programming. So what you see on this map in front of you and what makes our work so interesting and fascinating is the darker the color, the higher the energy burden of the customer. And what you can see that's so fascinating and part of why it's so fun to build customer programs at Snohomish County PUD is, again, the needs of our energy burden customers in Oso and Darrington are not necessarily going to be the same needs of our energy burden customers along that I-5 corridor, right? And so when we think about program design and program development, again, we have done a great job through the years of having these big open entry programs that can cover kind of a big broad need of the customer base. But as we start thinking about how do we get more detailed, we need programs that are going to acutely serve urban customers really well and their unique needs, and rural customers, customers that are in multifamily housing and customers that are single family households. And so when we look at kind of the detail now that we have at our fingertips from a data standpoint using our external vendor and then pairing them with our internal analytics team, we're able to get very, very refined about who needs what and how we may best serve them. And again, just so you know, part of why Missy is on the team that I'm on in energy services is we don't view energy assistance work and energy efficiency program work as two things that are discontinuous with one another, right? But it's that they are deeply integrated, and what we're going to be doing over the next several months, several years, is how do we integrate those things further, right? Because that's how the end-use customer receives a great benefit, but then every single ratepayer can look at the good work we're doing, and they can see how it satisfies a number of outcomes that are for all our good. And it's why I say this whenever we talk about the energy services budget, but I'll say it when we talk about this work. It's not a cash spend, but it's an investment, right? Like, it's an investment in the community, it's an investment in the customer, and the deliverables that we owe to the state and others. So let's get even more detailed. Check this out. So if we wanted to look a little bit more at Oso and Darrington, one of the things we can do is we can really start to drill down at the census tract level, at the zip code level, and we can go, so what is unique about the needs of the customers that maybe live on these three census tracts that are up at the top? And one of the first things that jumps out is whenever we dig a little bit deeper at these energy burden customers, is we see that there are pretty low numbers in terms of discount program participation and LIHEAP. Now, we can make a lot of assumptions potentially as to why that is, right? They're probably the farthest removed from downtown Everett of any of our customers. And where do you go to get your LIHEAP appointment? But you have to get to downtown Everett, so that's part of it, right? But we can ask ourselves questions about maybe there's a way that we're marketing our discount program and positioning our discount program in this part of the county that maybe makes it less appealing or somewhat inaccessible to these folks. And how do we reformat what we do to maybe reach them? Conversely, we can look at another area or another census tract. And now this is an area really close to our community solar project that we're working on at Walter Hall, the Casino Road area. And one of the things that jumps off the page when we dig a little bit deeper into this customer group is we see there's a high concentration of multifamily housing, there's a high concentration of renters, there's a high concentration of people of color and people that have a different language that's spoken in the home other than English. And so once again, we can ask ourselves, is our programming accessible to these customers? Do we have the right multifamily energy efficiency programs that will also lead to energy assistance and energy burden reduction in these multifamily situations where there's this renter-owner challenge, where there's building and property management, and how do we interact with them in such a way to target programs to serve these customers just as effectively as if you own your own home and you're somewhere out rural? So now we've got, I keep joking, but we bought a Ferrari, and that's really what I feel like we have when it comes to the data and analytics of what we get. Not only do we get this neutral third-party evaluation, but we've got the opportunity to pair this great data with our program team, where we've always had great success already, and go, okay, what are the right micro-targeted ways to serve this customer group effectively? I also want to show one of the things we get on our map that's pretty cool is those green and burgundy dots, those show houses of worship, those show community organizations and agencies that are already working in those territories. So when we get to this next thing, which we're talking about phase three of our program marketing and outreach, what we can do is not only build and design the programs that are specific for communities and target and deliver them to these small subsets of customers, but now we've also got the ways of thinking strategically about, instead of the personality that we've always had is, hey, we got a great program for y'all, y'all come. Instead, it's like, how do we instead go to where people already are, where people are already doing good work, where people are already trusting those community partners, and how do we make sure that we message it, that we build it, that we market it to their and our shared customers in a way that they can actually respond and access the assistance that we're offering. And so Missy alluded to it, but it's kind of a full blitz. And just know that it is not lost on us that not everyone is a part of sort of the digital transformation. And so we have no intention of removing any of the analog ways customers want to interact with us, whether that's in person, whether that's paper and mail and that sort of thing. But what we also want to do is be aware that, you know, I think in the last study I saw, I did see that 83% of income qualified customers do own a smartphone. And that was data from like 2023. And that was one of those, it's another one of those kind of common misconceptions that maybe that's not a great channel. And a lot of the data would suggest it's actually still a really good channel, but all these other ways can't go out the window either. And we have no intention of that. We just want to add to it. And we want to be a little bit more tactical when we say yes to a community event. One of the things we're going to be looking at is we're going to be looking at our map, and we're going to be looking at who that community event serves and how we can kind of thread that need with all the needs of our collective customers to do it the right way. So that's what we're working on. We can answer a lot of questions, but we're excited to talk about this, and we're going to be really excited to kind of come back and show you the results of some of these micro programs that we're going to build, among other things. So with that, questions?
This is,
yeah.
But where this work has come from last 10, 15 years, I mean, it is phenomenal.
Well, you've done so much since the last time we heard from you. What was it, 5 years ago? I don't know. But you've done so much more recently that it is just phenomenal. I agree with Commissioner Olson, it's phenomenal. I just have one comment, and it relates to your slide number 7 and your final slide about marketing and outreach at a micro level. At some point in the past, when you were presenting, maybe it wasn't the whole picture, but you were presenting, and it was either I or one of the people who phoned in talked about or asked, could you possibly get your, could you connect at the food bank level? And we were told, no, not can't do, no can do. So now you might want to look at that again. Because even in Edmonds, which is not considered low, we have huge people who use our food bank. It's a really good food bank. And so, just so you know.
No, and that's a great comment. And we actually have been able to do some shared events where we give away energy efficient products at food banks. And we've had some tabling events in the recent the last couple of years. But you're right. I mean, that's a great resource as well, and another place where the community is already gathering. And that's 100% how we're trying to think of it, is where are folks already gathering and saying, hey, I'd like some help, and how do we show up there as well so that they don't have to tell us again, right?
Yeah, I don't know about all the other food banks, but I presume there are quite a few, but I just know about the Edmonds one. It's huge, heavily used.
No, that's great. We'll take that note for sure. Thank you.
I do have two. And just related to the program in general, I just had a couple of questions. Do those on the program still not have to reapply annually?
So if you are not a senior, it's every other year. So every 2 years, we ask you to reapply. Uh-huh. If you are a senior, it's every 5 years that we ask you to reapply. Okay. And part of that, again, we wanted to make it as open as we could for seniors.
Yeah.
But there's also sometimes challenges where family moves into a household with an elder member of the family, that person may pass on, and it's just our opportunity to do that quick pulse check hey, is everything still the same? And again, we try to make it really quick and easy, especially for our seniors.
Number two question. Do we still face challenges with energy efficiency work and opportunities in the unit, but the owner, you have to get permission from the owner? Is that still a challenge for us?
Very much so. But it's a challenge that we're, I would say over the next year, we're going to be attacking that head on. And some of which we'll be talking about in future conversations is the State HERES program and the award we were just given about that. And our phase one of our proposed program design, which we're still working out the details, we believe will empower renters to take full advantage of this program initially with or without the owner's consent. And then there's a second gate that we've envisioned that they can partner with an owner, where the owner and the renter can get the benefit of it. And so we'll be excited to share that with you guys in the next few months as we kind of get that built and filed with the state.
Well, I didn't use the word obstacle, John, but opportunity, because I know it's been a challenge for you.
Yeah, and I'll just say, like, those are the kind of challenges, though, that our current team of program managers and energy services and engineers, we love that stuff. And our team is like always thinking about those kinds of things. And I think, again, now having, you know, Missy and this energy assistance work more deeply connected to the energy efficiency teams, we've got the ability to just think strategically about how do we make all these dollars drive to the shared outcomes that we need, right?
Thank you.
Any other
questions,
commissioners? I
think I lost it. Well, I have a comment and question, so maybe it'll come to you.
Maybe, yeah.
First off, what a phenomenal rich data set. I mean, as you are going through the presentation, I'm thinking, well, you know, oh, so Darrington, maybe there's some community events we could attend. The Latino neighborhood, I mean, you could, you know, door hangers and specifically contacting those landlords to say, hey, we would like to do some energy efficiency improvements in your buildings. I mean, that is really breaks it down to or, you know, has the potential to break it down to some bite-sized pieces that we can.
Very much. I'm more worried about having to put restrictions on Missy, myself, and the team as to how many hours a day we can kind of really spend on the dashboard. Because it is one of those where, like, you can keep asking questions, right? And you can add another filter. You can add another filter. And then all of a sudden you can be like, well, here's the thing we're gonna do for these 27 households. And it's kind of like, okay, easy.
Yes, so, yeah. But the idea of making the process more efficient so we're not spending time processing paper makes a lot of sense. And that's optimistic how many people we've got. So the first question I had is, how are we helping vision impaired customers? I have an elderly parent who relies on the help of others. He can't go with Siri or Alexa, can't really negotiate those kinds of things. So if we have a independent hearing or a vision impaired customer, how do we help them?
That's an excellent question that I don't know that we have an answer to. I know we used to have a Braille services contractor that we used to make sure we had Braille billing available.
Yeah.
But in terms of this work specifically, I don't know that we've...
Well, my first thought would be...
Can you just go?
Oh, yeah, sorry. My first thought would be utilization of our field reps, where they could have a field rep actually come out and ask the questions, and the field rep could help the customer fill it out, the form directly online. And as far as...
That's a pretty good answer.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I'm glad. I'll stop there.
No, that's the answer. Yeah, you said that, and I didn't. So the next thing is you asked us how often we wanted to. And, you know, I think in our role, this is a pretty important part for probably all of us to understand these are our customers, and in a lot of ways need our help the most. And sort of the key in the public, I think that I would like it more often to understand our progress and our obstacles. I think it also helps us as we expand programs to understand if you come back to us because you've been so successful, and now when we budget, we're budgeting a larger amount. It'll be helpful to understand the journey that you're on and to know where we need to be as an organization. So,
Commissioner, what time period would be? I always like to look at trends, and sometimes, you know, if you say 6 months or a year, you don't capture the overall trends. I'm not open to 6 months.
I was thinking 2 years is better than five.
Oh, well, you got my vote.
But 1 year is better than two. I'm fine either way. I just think, I mean, I think you'll know when there's a direction or when there's, I mean, this is really phenomenal information and phenomenal news.
I think you're going to be able to find ways to succinctly present this without every possible detail. You could, in other words, kind of order a progress report from where we are today as you go forward. And Commissioner Logan did jog my memory, and it had to do with energy efficiency. That was my question. Since we do not, RPUD, as I understand it, no longer does energy audits, how do you determine the energy efficiency needs of a dwelling?
Yeah, so one of the things we can do and that our data lends itself to is we look at the heat signature of a home, and we can actually see the consumptive data as it relates to the year. And that tells us a lot.
Yeah.
And then a lot of the detail that we can get at the county assessor level and some other demographic data sources that our vendor uses, we can learn things like what is the last recorded heat type that was known. We can know the vintage of the home. And then if we're starting to talk about, is it single family or is it multifamily, it's fairly easy to start making a lot of assumptions, like based on some of those just top line levels as to where the biggest opportunities might lie as it relates to energy efficiency. But then again, once we get the customer into a different program, now we can actually have this kind of mutual dialogue with the customer, right, where we could blast a list of customers with a certain kind of consumptive data over a certain type of period of time in a certain housing stock, and we could say, our records indicate, our data indicates that you might be well served by this kind of program. Do you have interest in learning more about that program? And then we can kind of be proactive in the way we market and connect with that customer when we've got the right programs to offer.
Okay.
And that's what we're going to do.
Can I add to that? I'm sorry, I'm going to add something. This is just a challenge that is always in the back of my head, especially when it comes to our low-income customers and our income-qualified customers. If they're walking through their house and flipping on the heat, and it's old baseboard heaters that were put in place in 1979, but there's heat pumping out of that, they're not looking at replacing that. They don't care because they're trying to figure out if they're going to put food on the table. So that just adds to the challenge. Even if when we get them on the radar, making sure that we're designing the right programs, that is going to be something that they can manage and sustain. Because when people are, when they don't have the funds to fix something that's not broken, that's a big ask. To ask them to come up with money to fix something that's not broken.
That is so true. And I think we need more programs to help people switch over to heat pumps, because since we switched over to heat pumps, our electric bills have gone down.
for some reason. Well, actually, we got off gas for the most part. But I think I mentioned it before, we're averaging like $4 a day for a fairly good-sized house. With, you know, no natural gas.
Might need to move in.
Huh?
I might need to move in.
Well, it was, but it was a big investment upfront.
And that's...
But that's why we need more programs to help people who don't have the funds to get some heat pumps.
Ms. Olson, any follow-up?
I have none.
You know, you made me think of another question that I had that I didn't ask, and that is, I'm wondering if as we get Connect Up established through, can we look at those profiles and understand, you know, you can go to the county's website, you have all the data on square footage and those kinds of things. Is there ways we can use that data to identify customers who may be have a very inefficient home that we can then contact?
Yes.
Good.
Yeah, and our team's looking forward to, you know, getting even more granular data that we can kind of put up against what we've already kind of collected, and how do we use it to make even better program decisions.
Right.
But, you know, to your comment about heat pump, I mean, next time we're sharing, when we're only talking about energy services stuff, we'll be happy to talk about some of the stuff we've got in the works there too.
Thank you so much. So grateful to you.
Yes, thanks. Jeff and Missy, and again, just a huge kudos to them, the entire team. And I think what I'm most proud of, and you saw it demonstrated, is their passion to actually make a difference with our customers. And it's reflected in the great work that you're doing. So thank you. Maybe a break?
Okay. That is 10:11. Let's take a 10-minute break. Well, let's take a 9-minute break and come back at 20 after. It's 10:20 and we are back.
All right,
thanks,
John. Next up, update on our work around organized market, and that's Garrison Marr, Adam Cornelius, Tofina. Hellstrom, maybe?
No.
The brainiacs.
Washed his hands of that. So we'll start with Garrison Marr. Good morning, Garrison.
Morning.
Garrison Marr, Senior Manager of Power Supply. While I've got the microphone, just quick opportunity. That was an awesome presentation by Jeff and Missy.
Yes.
And I think it's one of the reasons it's so cool to work at PUD is the smart folks we have that are really dedicated to what they do and serving the public. And I just inspired by it and really appreciated it.
But he set the bar high for presentations.
He did. And so I thought maybe by acknowledging how great that was, we just appropriately would have a discussion on markets. But I do want to, you know, lay out for folks that, you know, organized markets are really fluid in the Pacific Northwest and Western United States right now. We're seeing people lean in different directions. That's going to shape the operating environment. It's going to impact how much our resources are worth, how much our transmission is worth, what the cost of some of the dispatch through the system is, cost of load services. It essentially is shaping the operating environment. It's important stuff. We intend to be back with you all on roughly a quarterly basis so that we can keep the commission apprised of what's changing out there, how we'll respond to that, and make sure that we have a shared strategy for moving forward. And this is part of that. That's part of the reason there's so many dates on the prior presentations, and we intend to do that in the future as well. I also want to take the opportunity to brag a little bit about Adam and Joe. You know, if the Pacific Northwest does not advocate for the design features that'll work well for the Pacific Northwest, they just won't be there to the same degree. It's really important work. Joe and Adam are both regional experts, and they both have been invited to, you know, some national stages too on their markets works. We're very lucky to have the subject matter experts that we have, and they've been doing an awesome, awesome job in the interests of our ratepayers. So I'll hand it over to Adam with that high bar reset.
Good morning, commissioners. And thank you, Garrison. My name is Adam Cornelius. I'm a power analyst in our power supply department. And as Garrison mentioned, I've been really leading up our efforts on organized markets. You know, today is really informational only. We're not, you know, requesting any near-term action by the board. But you know, as Garrison mentioned, there are quite a few pieces right now, and thought it was a good time to come and provide an update and an opportunity to address any questions you all may have. So, you know, feel free to stop me anytime or at the end, kind of checkpoints along the way. So we'll start out with kind of a refresher on organized markets, what may be changing, and how the district has been engaged. And you know, just highlight that one of our priorities has really been to preserve multiple day-ahead market options for utilities, including Bonneville and ourselves, to choose from. And so we'll talk through where each of those two options are out there right now, SPP's Markets Plus and the CAISO's Extended Day-Ahead Market, or EDAM, kind of where they stand. And of course, we will ultimately be tied to Bonneville's decision, and so we'll discuss their process as well. And then we'll kind of give an outline of where things are going moving forward. So, starting with the kind of refresher and background, you know, just wanted to give a reminder of some of the potential benefits of utilities, including UD and Bonneville doing an organized wholesale market. You know, first, that you know, all these markets use an optimization engine that really the objective is to provide the least cost solution to serve load, and it also offers a greater ability for utilities to sell surplus power, or you know, in our case, flexible hydropower, and shape that water really into the most valuable time periods, which is you know, benefit to us and our customers. We've all heard about challenges and the need to build new transmission, and well, day-ahead markets won't necessarily solve that on their own. They do help maximize the use of the system we have by really utilizing all the transmission made available to the market as it's needed. And the third point there on the top is really the potential for ability to integrate renewables. And that's, you know, I think really linked to the first two. Both through the geographic diversity from a wide market footprint, as well as the sort of automated dispatch of generators and that ability for them to ramp up and down quickly to respond to the variability that you know renewables pose. So in the past 5 to 10 years, most utilities in the West have joined a real-time organized market. Either CAISO's Western Energy Imbalance Market, or EIM, that's where Bonneville joined and the PUD came along with it, or SPP's WISE Market, which is located primarily in the Southwest and Intermountain West. And you know, we do see in the EIM each of those above benefits realized, but it's at a relatively small scale. Only a fraction of energy is really available to be optimized and settled in that real-time time frame. And a vast majority of trading is still bilateral. Moving forward, as you're you know, aware, many utilities are working on developing and thinking about joining one of two day-ahead market options, right? So it's EDAM or SPP's Market Plus. You know, there will still be some level of bilateral trading, particularly in the kind of midterm, longer term time horizons. But ultimately, nearly all energy dispatch decisions would be optimized and then settled by the market operator. And so we would expect to see all those benefits increase. But that also means that the importance of market design and good governance become magnified when you're talking about a day-ahead market. And, you know, this, our wholesale market involvement, you know, is big, right? We have, you know, on the order of, it varies from year to year, $100 million or more in our wholesale transactions when you combine both the buy and the sell side. And, you know, that this environment is likely to, you know, really impact that, for, you know, hopefully, ideally for the better. But it just really, given that, you know, huge impact, we've been found it important to actively participate in the market development discussions. And we believe this, you know, both, you know, gives us the opportunity to help influence the market design, but also to understand what might be coming at us and prepare for, you know, participating in one of these day-ahead markets. So, you know, for a few years now, we've had an internal organized team with representatives from power supply, power scheduling, regional transmission, and our legal departments. We meet regularly to provide, you know, to share updates on market developments and to coordinate our engagement. We have actively participated in stakeholder processes. As you're aware, last spring, the commission approved our request to fund and become a voting member of Markets Plus Phase 1. And we really felt that that step was important because, you know, it appeared that EDAM was moving forward almost no matter what, with PacifiCorp's very strong interest there. And we wanted to have a second option and preserve a second option for utilities to consider and, you know, provide a little bit of competition for EDAM. But, you know, given the uncertainty that we're facing in the space, we, you know, do also participate in the EIM and EDM processes, as well as, of course, in Bonneville's market decision process. Often this is direct, but often we also, you know, utilize and leverage our trade organizations, particularly PPC and PGP. They have great staff expertise or good forums for us to engage with our peers. So maybe just before I turn to some specific updates, any questions on what I've shared so far?
I do, and I'm a little bit embarrassed because I've been thinking about a lot of this and hearing about it for years now, a couple of years. And I have wondered, and I'm going to just confess, I don't understand whether the term day ahead is literal or figurative.
So,
is it literally one day ahead of when you, it is literally one day ahead of purchasing or so?
Yeah, and so there's things that happen in those markets that are longer term, but really the kind of decision, the actual optimization engine runs the day before. And so
exactly one day, okay.
Yeah, so right now, we trade things on a month ahead basis, or a year ahead, or a quarter, you know, all different time scales. But then, when it gets close to operations, we have what's called pre-schedule, which is often the day before, but sometimes when there's a weekend or things like that, it's several days before. This is, you know, every day at 10 o'clock in the morning. Everyone, all generators and loads have to submit their bids to the market. And then the engine runs, takes a couple hours to spit out a solution, and that tells everybody their kind of day ahead position. Then everybody has a chance to update, new information's coming, loads are higher, wind's going down, all that, you know, whatever might be happening over the course of the day. And every hour, there's a new opportunity for everybody to update their bids and offers.
Then you switch to real time.
You switch to real time. Okay. Yep.
So the reason I wondered about this is I wondered, well, how can you know what's going to happen the day ahead? And that's, but you can switch to real time.
Correct. And so it, so, you know, it's kind of like day ahead markets aren't really, day ahead markets aren't really only a day ahead market. You want to give their whole like description of what they do, it's a day ahead and real time market in conjunction.
Okay, so it is fairly literal. It's a literal term.
Yeah, that's when the first run happens, and then there's a second run in real time.
Thank you.
That is, trying to true up to all
Thank
the
you.
All
I
the
really, I did really
our forecast errors exist in data.
I really did need to understand.
Yeah, that's a good question. And then the name is a little tricky. Okay, so I'll first talk a little bit about Markets Plus and where that stands. Markets Plus, SVP kind of established a two-phase development process. We're currently in phase one, which is essentially writing the rules for market participation. The first step in that was to develop a tariff, which are kind of a formal set of rules that have to be filed and approved by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC. And that was completed and filed by SPP at the end of March. So now we're working on the next kind of sub-step here, which is the development of protocols. Protocols are sort of the next layer down, the more technical details of how market participants will actually interact with the market. And that work's expected to be completed by the end of the year. Phase two is implementation, which will kick off next year. That's where SPP and participants will really turn to developing the software, other systems, communication protocols, and really stand up everything they need to do, at FPP organizations, as well as individual utilities, other market participants, to actually, participate in the market prior to go live. And that is a 2 to 3 year process that will, expect to start next year. We expect SPP to seek funding for that phase near the end of this year. And just kind of given the nature of the work, it is expected to be a higher cost, significantly higher cost than phase one. But kind of more to come on that. This is a probably too detailed slide, so apologies. But I really just wanted to show some of the key areas where our staff focused our efforts and wanted to acknowledge, the extensive contributions of all of our great team members. It's not just me, even though I'm the one you usually hear from on this. I think I would say it's fair to say that on really each of these topics, UD engagement has helped move the ball forward, and that the tariff landed in a place where we're pretty comfortable. I'm not going to go through all of them unless you want me to, but I would maybe highlight a couple that I think are, we really see as core strengths of Markets Plus. Right at the top there is governance. And, I think there's kind of two things that we like about the governance in Markets Plus. One is it's really kind of the entire framework, starting with policy development on through the development of the tariff and the protocols and all the work that's to come. It's really been driven by stakeholders, through the work groups and task forces that we've all been participating in. And in FPP staff really plays the role of an expert guide. They implement what stakeholders kind of decide on. And the second piece is the oversight from what's called the Markets Plus Independent Panel. Is really truly independent. They're not beholden to any particular interest group or region within the footprint. Along the kind of stakeholder leadership lines, I would just highlight this Markets Plus legal group that's mentioned there. And that concept, came from our own Joe Fina. Early in the tariff development process, he identified the need for a Markets Plus stakeholder legal group that he ended up chairing. And this group met regularly, provided a forum for the attorneys to kind of wrangle over the the legal language and allowed subject matter experts to focus on the technical details of market design. I was very happy that I didn't have to do as much of that work, so that was great. The second, maybe kind of high level point I would add is on resource adequacy and reliability. Markets Plus does require participation in the Western Resource Adequacy Program. You've heard folks from our group, Garrison and others, talk about the importance of that program moving forward. And I think what that does is it puts everybody, all the market participants, all the utilities that would join this market on a level playing field in terms of ensuring that everyone is bringing sufficient supply to the table on that longer term planning horizon, which then in turn really supports reliable operations as it moves into the operation timeframe, that day ahead and real time timeframe across the entire footprint. Be happy to touch on any others if you have questions or expand on the two that I talked about there.
Questions or comments?
About their obligation rules that have to be compatible with hydro resources, which are limited.
Mm-hmm.
How does that work?
Yeah, so there are a lot of work went into, and so the RAP program is a separate program. This is kind of
right. I know that.
How do we take this kind of long term, 7 month ahead forward showing you have to do, and bring it to this ahead real time, very near term horizon? And so the way that works is every participant, every utility, has to offer sufficient supply to cover their load effectively, plus a kind of reserve margin into the market. And so that may not always be as much as what you had to show in your forward showing, right? Our load is varying all the time. The forward showing is really around our peak. And so the rule is you don't have to all the time, 24/7, across all periods, peak, on peak, et cetera, off peak, et cetera, bring all of your supply to the table. And that's important for hydro resources in particular, because what we tend to have a lot of capacity on any given hour, we could meet enough, we could hit our peak. We can't bring that all the time, right? We have to shape it to our load. So the way the must offer obligation is structured, it allows us to do that.
So how is that made? I'm wondering about the accountability on that. That if we say, well, we don't have enough, but we really do, there's somebody monitoring that.
Yeah, absolutely. And enough is, in any given hour, you're showing that you're bringing, you're offering enough resource into the market to meet your own load. There's an accounting that happens through the market operator. There's a check on that. There's a penalty structure if someone doesn't do that.
Thank you.
Yeah. I have just a general question. I'm sure throughout that the folks that are working on all of these options are considering manipulation of the market.
Yeah, definitely.
To protect that from happening again.
That's definitely one of the goals. Yeah. That SPP has a market monitoring unit that was very active in the stakeholder processes. And so as these kind of tariff rules were brought forth, they would provide their own comments on them, and
okay,
stakeholders would take that into account. And across the board, we were able to land a place that generally the market monitor was comfortable with.
Okay.
And there will be, FERC will look at it with that same lens as they're looking at the tariff.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, no, exactly.
I don't have a question, just an observation. I think I've said this before in a different way, but first of all, I'm so proud that we're so involved in all of this and helping lead the way. But the governance part is so important to me, and someone stated it better than this, but essentially, it's not the program we're gonna start out with when we implement. It's the ability, because everything changes over time, it's the ability to be involved in that, to have a fair seat at the table, to make sure that the change works for all the market participants and not for a few as well.
Yeah, absolutely. There'll be some things on this list or otherwise that we didn't get right. These are sort of new designs, like the day ahead and real-time market that isn't a full RPO is kind of novel, both EDAM, in the EDAM and Markets Plus space. So we're learning as we're going, we're building on lessons learned, but it'll inevitably be something we didn't get right. And every single RTO has dozens probably of tariff filings with FERC every year where they're tweaking or making major changes to elements of their market design. So I agree completely.
Yeah, and the value for hydro, as I think about it, really represents some interesting challenges, right? Because we might be able to help that our need, but there's also the need to hold water back at times.
Mm-hmm.
So even though there's always probably power available, we also have to have that long-term strategy every year, every month, every day.
Yep.
And so, yeah, interesting.
Yeah, I think it's the kind of thing that our hydro operators, the BPA's hydro operators, are kind of constantly thinking of. And it's a different framework when you're offering into the market.
Yeah.
What's the right price at which I'm willing to sell this many megawatt hours, as opposed to kind of dealing with a single bilateral counterparty.
When someone else controls the throttle.
What's that?
When someone else controls the throttle.
Yeah. Yeah. But there are a lot of, you know, there are a number of ways where we're able to, you know, make sure that we can actually reflect all the different limitations those resources have while still providing the flexibility when it's available.
This is an extraordinary team on this slide.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's impressive.
So just maybe a quick run through of the FERC process for Markets Plus. FVP, as I mentioned, filed their tariff at the end of March. Vast majority of participants that participated in phase one filed supportive comments. Snohomish, we joined with Chelan and Tacoma, who are also active. And are still active in the Markets Plus development, supportive joint comments, TPC file comments and support, Bonneville and many others. Just about every major filing at FERC does get concerns and things of that nature. So there were several parties who raised concerns or asked clarifying questions in their comments. Some of the topic areas included transmission usage, the framework for GHG, potential seams issues with CAISO or EDAM. So SPP, as is typical, the market operator filed an answer kind of addressing all of those, and then certain entities kind of hit on topics that were important to them. We didn't file an answer, but we did help, we contributed heavily to PPC's response. Bonneville also filed comments addressing some of those concerns. So, there could be some further back and forth, but we're primarily in wait and see mode here. SPP requested approval of the tariff by the end of July, but FERC is not under an obligation to meet that timeline, given how far out the actual implementation and effective date of the tariff.
Joe Fino is our FERC. You don't have to get up, but I'm just in my mind. Our FERC nerd, FERC nerd is Joe. and Jeff also, right? Didn't you work on FERC quite a bit?
I backed up Joe, but no, I was mostly on the Bonneville side.
Oh, okay. BPA. Okay, thank you. Thank you. Because I'm aware of how. What complicated, drawn out, anything with FERC is. Yeah.
Any other questions on Markets Plus? Otherwise, I'll turn to EDAM.
I do want do have a seams question, but we can talk about it later if you do. So, you know, I see seams used as a sword and as a solution. How challenging are seams? And what we're talking about, right, if two markets are essentially next door to each other, it's that figuring out the rules and the electronic ability to communicate back and forth and have that be fair and equitable. How can you give us a perspective about, is this done other places in the nation? Is this seamless? No pun intended.
Sadly, not seamless. The seams do like will exist in this framework. They exist today, right? I mean, there are seams between EIM entities and the CAISO between when a market participant tries to sell into CAISO not through EIM, through the market and their neighbors that aren't in any market. So seams exist. They will exist when there's, presuming two markets move forward, there are different set of challenges to deal with. In the East, you know, most of the East is covered by a variety of markets, right? FPP kind of butts up against MISO, which butts up against PJM and New York ISO and the independent and the New England ISO. So they all have one or more seams with another neighboring market, and there have been challenges, absolutely. I think one of the challenges is, ideally, right, you would, like within the market engine's gonna run and spit out the best solution for that market, and then your neighbor's gonna do the same thing. Ideally, you'd be able to economically, through have a way to kind of economically transact across those market seams when needed. And there's been a lot of work done in the East. I think they are much improved than where they used to be. I think it continues. And I think it really, we haven't seen a lot of work on it yet because, you know, this tariff isn't even approved yet. Like, we don't know for sure that Markets Plus will be a going concern. I think there have been conversations started between SPP and CAISO. But I think once, you know, it's clear that both markets will be moving forward, those will really begin in earnest, and ideally we'll work out a way where we can kind of maximize or minimize the kind of friction associated with those seams. But kind of a, it's really to be determined.
Yeah, I mean, we know the CAISO's going to exist in their market.
CAISO exists. They're not going away.
So, I mean, obviously the challenge is that California is very dependent on our hydro at times. And we, you know, benefit from the opportunity of solar midday. And so I guess I'd be optimistic that because we both have a shared interest, we could, if we have two markets, the two markets can figure out a way to do that efficiently and fairly.
I am. And I think, you know, in the past, we've seen FERC, you know, require RTOs to, in the East, to kind of get together and figure something out. You see joint agreements between MISO and PJM, for example, that really kind of help manage that. And so I'm optimistic. It's an addressable problem. You know, it may not be perfect, but I think it's something that is, once we kind of get to that point, that, you know, we'll all get together and figure out a way, because the transmission lines exist, the need for trade exists, and, you know, I don't think just having two markets is a reason to, shouldn't, you know, kind of kill that.
Thank you.
Okay, EDAM. EDAM's a little further along than Markets Plus. FERC approved most of that tariff back in December. There was one element that CAISO had to refile that FERC initially rejected. That we'll see where that lands. But more or less, it's been largely approved by FERC. You've likely seen announcements from certain utilities intending to join EDAM with varying degrees of certainty. So, you know, PacifiCorp, you know, announced the moment it was approved by the board that they are going to join EDAM, and they've since signed an implementation agreement. Kind of the next tier are LADWP and the Balanced Area of Northern California. So these are two utilities that are not really part of CAISO proper, but they're in California. Pretty logical that they would, you know, opt for EDAM, given kind of their dependence on their interplay with the CAISO. Portland General Electric also has announced an intention to join, but I don't think they've signed an implementation agreement yet. And then we've heard from Idaho Power that they're leaning towards joining EDAM. And they had a couple of requirements that they put out there prior to committing, but it seems like they're, you know, moving, you know, likely would join EDAM. And then since the slide deck was finalized, Nevada Energy made public that their IRP will contain an intention to join EDAM. Now, unlike some of the other IOUs on this list, NVU does require its commission's approval before it can join a market. So I would add to that, probably leaning that last bullet there, NV Energy.
So Adam, is there some inherent benefit to some of these utilities? Obviously the California ones, I understand. But the others, is there some inherent benefit that they see in CAISO as opposed to Markets Plus? Is just the fact that one is going to happen for sure? Or what are your thoughts about what's driving some of these decisions?
Yeah, it's a good question. It could be in part that, you know, they are, I think, all EIM entities, so they have that kind of experience. It could be their level of transmission connectivity. Maybe they see an opportunity with the CAISO load. There are, into this on the next slide, there are movements on opening up CAISO's governance that, you know, maybe is enough to make them feel comfortable. But yeah, I think they probably each have their own set of motivations.
Okay. Well, question, and you got to it in terms of the governance model from CAISO.
Right.
Well, the lack thereof for those that are going to join, it's just interesting to me.
Yeah. So there is you're well aware, right? So we've long held some concerns with the existing CAISO governance structure. The Board of Governors is appointed by the California governor, and they have a statutory obligation essentially to look out for the California ratepayers. We're not alone in those concerns, and so last summer, a group of state regulators started the Westwide Governance Pathways Initiative, so known as the Pathways Initiative, or WOLA. I'm not sure if that's a pronounceable acronym. And you know, so they have this goal that is, you know, essentially to it really speaks to the development of a new organization that would offer some market services across the West. And really, it's essentially an effort to open up kinds of governance and make it more independent in response to some of the concerns. We've had an ongoing stakeholder process for the last, coming up on a year now. And last week, their launch committee unanimously approved the straw proposal that's outlined here. So step one is kind of some, I would say, pretty incremental changes that, you know, could slightly increase the authority of the EIM governing body. Or EDAM governing body when EDAM becomes a thing, but you know, the CAISO board would still retain its own the backstop authority in certain cases, and you know, they believe that no legislative changes in California are needed for this. So now that that's been approved by their launch, the Pathways Initiative Launch Committee, CAISO is going to start a stakeholder process to implement that step one.
How would you describe the progress of this Pathways Initiative?
Yeah, so
It's kind of a newer development, but is it promising? Because it seems like it would be ideal.
Yeah, so I would say that, by and large, regardless of which market Bonneville and the PUD ends up in, a more independent governance structure for CAISO is a good thing, even if we're not in that market. In part because of what we talked about, right? We're going to likely, FPP and CAISO would likely be negotiating SEAMS agreements. So having a broader governance structure for CAISO feels like all else equal, that would be beneficial. SEAMS aside, we'll continue to trade and would want to have, hopefully a broader perspective when, push comes to shove on their governance rules. In terms of how big of a deal this is, I think step one is, probably, as I said, a kind of incremental improvement. Step two is maybe a little more promising, but would require some enabling legislation from California, which has been tried a couple of times before without success. And so then step two would create a new organization separate from CAISO that would kind of take over from the EIM governing body. It would give that new organization what they call sole authority over market matters. So the market piece would no longer have this kind of CAISO board backstop that exists under kind of all frameworks that we've seen so far today. But CAISO would retain that kind of control over its balancing authority and like the reliability obligations kind of within its kind of home service territory there. And so I think there's a lot of questions about how that split happens, but if it works out, it's likely an improvement in terms of independent governance.
It seems promising, but I just want to ask you, what is PGP?
PGP is a public generating pool. So PPC is Public Power Council, and Public Power Council is kind of nearly all public power entities in the Northwest. PGP is a smaller set of utilities that own their own resources, typically are active in the wholesale market.
Thank you.
Any questions on this slide?
No.
So I have a question. I've been concerned about this, and not because I don't think it's a good idea. It's just I'm frustrated that it started so late. And so I'm curious how Bonneville is negotiating this, because this is sort of just a hybrid of the case of EDAM. And they're trying to make a decision. And step one could happen. We could see step one could happen, but then step two might happen after decision made, and so what are your thoughts about that? How is Bonneville working through this? Are we all going to slow down and wait to see what happens?
So currently Bonneville's on a timeline. We'll show a chart down the road that has a lot. I'm just going to jump to this timeline slide because it might help. So the first top slide there, the top row is SPP Markets Plus. The second kind of gold colored section is CAISO, and the blue section is Bonneville. And so Bonneville is intending to make a final decision on its, whether it will join a day ahead market, and if so, which one, in November of 2024. We can see that the kind of step one proposal is finalized from the the Pathways Initiative, but that still has to go through a CAISO stakeholder process. Presumably it'll move forward. It seems like most entities, in or outside of California are motivated on that step one. Step two will require legislative action by California, which, the soonest it will occur is in the next session, which is kind of the first part of 2025 there. So you're right, there's a timing mismatch. I think they are actively working on kind of answering that question of how they'll navigate it. And I know there was a meeting that Joe was on that I wasn't, so he may have some more thoughts.
Joe, can you introduce yourself, please?
Sure. I'm Joe Fina, Senior FERC Counsel. You're here to the district. And good morning, commissioners. So commissioner, yeah, I think you hit it right on the head. This is probably a little too late in coming. And I think what Bonneville will say is they're not in a position to wait. Because otherwise they're just gonna be left with what is left over while everyone else has already decided which market to go to. So as you take a look at step two in the pathways proposal, that really includes many assumptions that would need to be made, which Bonneville has said in his comments to the pathways folks that it's too much risk for them to wait to possibly have a particular kind of legislation, then to review what all the market rules are as it relates to that particular law, and then how that would impact Bonneville and all of its customers. And at that point, Markets Plus as another option. It may not have all of the funding, may not have all of the systems in place. So I think what I'm trying to get at is that if we want to maintain two viable options, Bonneville needs to continue making sure that they are two competitive options, and not making a decision now or waiting is a decision on the side.
Thank you, that makes sense. Thank you.
I would say, like, we have, I would say, observed some positive CAISO developments. The sort of renewed efforts at more independent governance, whether or not that kind of goes through or not. We've also seen CAISO maybe modeling after Markets Plus, and they really have tried to bring additional stakeholder involvement in their process. It's still very much a staff-led process, but I would say they've made some clear efforts at getting kind of stakeholder input early on if they bring something forward. And a focus on improving price formation, and really specifically along those lines is there was an issue that came up for hydro resources during the MLK weekend event and in EIM, and storage owners had experienced this previously, and they did kind of rush some a kind of quick initial response to that and are pushing through kind of a high priority a fix to some bidding rules. Again, these are all I think these are all positive regardless of which market we would end up in. And I think it's fair to wonder whether any of those developments would have actually moved forward without that competition of Markets Plus materializing. So just a little editorial. And any more questions on EDAM or sort of the interaction with EDAM or Markets Plus before I move on to the Bonneville processes?
No. The Pathways Initiative would absolutely have to have CAISO as a part of that review.
I don't think there's
CAISO.
There's different flavors of the kind of step two that are still probably being contemplated. I don't think in any of them does CAISO go away. I think that kind of role of CAISO relative to this new organization is what's maybe.
And is that proposal accessible if we wanted to read it? That step one proposal.
Yeah. I can give you we can give you a link to
I'd
that.
I'd be interested in that.
Yeah, absolutely. Getting close here. So Bonneville's day ahead market decision process really has been going on since last summer. Probably the main headline is that in April they issued a preliminary staff recommendation to one, pursue participation in day ahead market, and two, that Markets Plus is their preferable option, based on what they know so far. That's not a final decision, that's an initial piece of information they put out there, and then they have ongoing workshops leading up to a draft record of decision in August, and a final decision in November. And you know, they will take a whole, a kind of a more formal approach to wherever they land. I think they made it clear, at least publicly, that you know, they're still, it is very much a preliminary decision, their initial or preliminary recommendation, and they're evaluating. They'll have the ability to evaluate a lot more scenarios, for example, of different market footprints as they kind of lead into this, the more formal decision. Other kind of related Bonneville process I wanted to quickly touch on is their provider of choice process, which is where we're developing the power contracts for post-2028. And so assuming the bond will be in a day-ahead market for some or all of that contract, it's important the power products are market ready. And essentially we want Bonneville to operate the federal resources in the market in a way that maximizes benefits for its customers. And we'd like to see those benefits shared equitably across all the products. I would say this conversation has been slow to get started, but in the last few months, Bonneville has really started engaging and recognize the importance of engaging with customers on this issue through that provider choice process. So, more to come. I showed the timeline slide already. I don't know that there's a ton of new information here. This is kind of intended as a resource to put it all, together. Just quickly coming up in this year, right, we'll have on the market plus side, a decision from FERC on the tariff and wrapping up the protocol development leading into a phase two funding. CAISO is going to keep working on their EDAM implementation and more work to come on the governance initiative. And, Bonneville will be issuing a final record of decision on day-ahead markets by the end of the year, as well as getting moving quickly through the kind of remaining, the current step on their provider of choice process, which is policy implementation and drafting up contract templates.
Is there a possibility that BPA would be a participant in the Westwide initiative?
So I know they have provided comments to that process. If you're speaking of that kind of new organization that's being stood up, I don't know exactly how that structure will be. So I think it probably depends on kind of which direction they go in terms of their market position. And just a last wrap up slide here. We've been very engaged in all these processes. We think we've seen positive developments from our participation. This is a really fluid time as entities are making decisions, as we're awaiting rulings from FERC. These outcomes aren't always within our control, but we're going to continue to engage to help do the best we can for the district and our customers. And I'm hopeful that we'll have a clearer picture on a lot of those swim lanes over the next 6 to 12 months. And, of course, as always, we'll keep you informed as developments come up. So with that, I would take any more questions.
Questions or comments?
Thank you.
Just a comment and then a question. First of all, thank you. So, the three of us are constantly inundated with information from PPC and PNUC. So it's nice to bring this all together holistically and have this conversation. So thank you very much. So I know we're dealing with lots of hypotheticals today, but if 5 years from now there's two markets, will entities be able to switch the market they're in? Potentially, will some of these decisions that have already been made, are those forever decisions, or how does that work in markets typically?
I would say the decisions that have been announced, like in terms of somebody joining a market, those are probably pretty retractable if things go a different way. I mean, the implementation agreement is a pretty firm step, but until you're actually in a market and you've done that implementation work, maybe you know, who knows how the world, you know, will turn. I think once you're in a market, there's always that option. I think in the East there have been occasions of a utility switching from one market to another. It's pretty rare. It's probably a pretty big lift.
No, it's something we've been, I certainly have been wanting to hear about for a long time, and I really am grateful for the team and the work of the whole team and the presentation today.
Thanks. Great job, Adam. So, and yours is, again, another example of where we are absolutely making an impact and having influence on how this moves forward in a good way. So, very important.
It's so important because this is a big decision and we don't get to make it.
Yeah.
A lot of us to make it. So,
yeah,
working on it is really critical for us.
Yeah, absolutely. That is it for presentations this morning.
All right. It is now 11:13 and our meeting is recessed. The regular meeting will reconvene here in the Christian meeting room or online at 1:30 p.m.